in this hour of the show, we will be talking a little bit about writing from and about the Midwest. It is undeniable, whether you like it or not, the place where you live does shape you. There is no escaping it. And it is as true of the Midwest as any place else. Now, the Midwest sometimes gets a bad rap as being sort of flat and featureless. And Midwesterners are often characterized as being flat and featureless. Well, my friends, it's not true. You just got to look at it right. This morning in this part of the show, we will be talking about a collection of writing, nonfiction writing, about the Middle West. And we have in studio here the editor of this collection. It's called In the Middle of the Middle West, Literary Nonfiction from the Heartland. It's published by Indiana University Press. And the editor is Becky Bradway. She teaches at Illinois State University. Also here in the studio, one of the contributors to this collection, Philip Graham, who teaches here at the U of I, teaches creative writing. And joining us on the telephone, we have Sharon Solwitz. She is professor in the MFA creative writing program at Purdue. So, first of all, let's say hi to everybody.
Hello.
Philip, hello.
Hi.
And with us here on the telephone, I hope, we have Sharon Solwitz.
Professor. Hi there.
Good. Well, thanks great. Very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Okay, now... Look, we got a lot of things to talk about here, but maybe I want to do two things. First of all, some of the contributors to the collection In the Middle of the Middle West are scheduled to do a writing and a signing tomorrow at Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy. This is 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So if people are interested in that, they can go over there.
We'll sign books.
Then they'll sign books. Now, there's one other thing that Philip has asked to mention.
Please.
And that is... Well, first of all, if you can hang around later today on the Afternoon Magazine, mm-hmm. Celeste Quinn will be talking with some of the folks who are responsible for the U of I's new literary magazine, The Ninth Letter. So you can hear more about that later. There also will be a launch party, mm-hmm. right? And yeah. this is tonight, mm-hmm. right? And where and when?
It's at Temple Buell Hall in the auditorium, and it's from 7 to 9. Three people who are in the magazine... a poet, a fiction writer, and a nonfiction writer will be giving readings. One of them will be Mae Barenbaum, and also Steve Almond, and also Gabrielle Corcovesi. And after their reading, there'll be drinks and refreshments available, and a reception for the authors and the editors and anybody who cares to come. So we're hoping that anybody who's interested will attend.
All right.
As well as we hope that everybody will come in. Get a signed copy of In the Middle West.
As if you haven't got enough stuff to do
day.
This weekend.
Right, exactly.
That's right. Okay, good. Well, again, I thank you all very much for being with us to talk about this. Maybe I'll start with Becky Bradway and just ask a very, not very interesting question about how it is that this all got started.
Well, it was something that I thought about doing for a long time. I grew up in this area. I am a big reader, obviously, and I was always... sort of stunned and shocked and dismayed by how few anthologies exist of Midwestern writers. It's really, compared to other areas of the country, it's really a neglected area because there's a huge genre of Southern literature. You can find tons and tons of anthologies of that. There's even a few anthologies of New England literature, and the West is also very good at promoting itself as a desirable region. And I was always kind of curious about why this was and why we seem to sort of have an inferiority complex about ourselves, I guess. And so it had always been in the back of my mind, and an opportunity came up. I had published another book on Indiana University Press, and it seemed that the time might be right for me to propose a project like this. And I did, and I gathered together some pieces from some really good writers, and they took it, and the book was created.
Mm-hmm. Let me, I want to turn to Sharon Solwitz. One of the things I'm curious about, now Philip here, I know he is not a native Midwesterner. He was born on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. Sharon, did you grow up in the Midwest?
From a perspective of the Midwest, I'm maybe an Easterner. I grew up in Cleveland.
Well, that's pretty close.
I'm still encompassed by it. I still say my A's that way.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm interested. Maybe I'll ask you, and then Philip can talk about it too, to pick up on this idea that Becky Bradway laid out about how people here in the Midwest have something of an inferiority complex. And, you know, it was necessary to champion Midwest writers and writing. I mean, why do you think that that is?
Well, I mean, there's a view that the only place, I mean, it's that image from The New Yorker, the sort of famous image from The New Yorker cover. You know, New York is all, and then there's this kind of, you know, strip that's about the size of a finger, and then there's California. I mean, I think we do take on that that image. It's fairly pervasive. Chicago tries to assert itself, but we still call ourselves the second city, you know.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Phil?
Well, I think that I like to think of the flatness of the Midwest as actually a horizontal cliff, and it's actually really very high.
That's very writerly of you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, first of all, the Midwest isn't nearly as flat as, well, say, Champaign-Urbana. And you can go to some really wonderful places that are absolutely beautiful. So I think that's interesting that a particular kind of landscape is what typifies a region that isn't really necessarily typical of that region, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's also something that I noticed coming from the East that might have to do with the sense of writers feeling, in some sense, if only unconsciously, isolated. And that is, growing up in the East, there's this one vast, big batch of people from Maine mm-hmm. all the way down to Richmond and beyond, and a town sort of never ends. It kind of blends from one into the other. What I noticed, especially in this part of the country, in this part of the Midwest, is that Champaign-Urbana ends. Mm-hmm. I mean, it stops, and then there's corn and soybeans. Mm-hmm. And then there's that, and then you get to St. Joe, or you get to Farmer City, you get to Decatur, whatever. I mean, and so what it seems to me is that after a certain point, I began to realize that I was living in a vast inland sea of corn and soybeans, and that all the little towns constituted a kind of archipelago, you know? And so towns really become dependent upon themselves. They kind of have to go inward in some sense because they're all really surrounded. You know, you're not really right next to the next town. And something about that, I think, is maybe breeds a kind of isolation, a kind of inwardness, maybe. I'm not so sure if I'm taking this too far.
I think one sense of place really differs whether you're in a city or a small town.
That's true.
Because I think in Chicago, that's probably closer in experience to what you were describing about living in the East.
Yeah.
I have to go really far to get to the, I don't think I even get to the corn and soybeans. I get to maybe where they sell apples, and that's about an hour and a half away.
Yeah.
So I feel I can go months without having a sense of being anywhere specific, you know, geographically mm-hmm. located, mm-hmm. except by buildings.
I actually grew up in the country, not that far from here, outside of Springfield. So I have come from that small town environment, and it does. I agree that it does tend to breed a sort of inward sense of isolation. But I think also with the coming of the media, television, radio, the internet, mm-hmm. that part of the sense of insecurity almost has to do with the sense that there are lots of things going on in other places that aren't going on here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I've moved other places, and it's a little bit of an illusion. Mm-hmm. There are things that go on in other places, but I think you tend to downgrade whatever it is that's happening around you. It's sort of, you almost absorb those cultural stereotypes about yourself. And I also think that because the area is in a state of, I think, transition, not just because of the media, but because of the agricultural economy has changed a lot. And people that were from small towns now need to live in bigger cities to get jobs. All of this has created almost a sense of rootlessness that, and so in a sense, I could also agree with Sharon that once, while it might have been easy to have a sense of identity to your small town, people are beginning to move away. So there's just this sense of, I think, people scrambling to identify themselves. And that was one of the things I really saw come out in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about this idea of how it is that place, how it is people are shaped by place, mm-hmm. this relationship between the geography, capital G, and people's inner geography. How does that work, and how particularly do you think that works in the Midwest?
Well, it's interesting. I once remember talking to a friend, the wife of a colleague, many, many years ago, and saying to her how oppressed I was by the flatness around me. I was having a real difficult time getting used to that, and that ironically I felt claustrophobic somehow. That, you know, in seeing everything as far as the eye could see, I sort of felt boxed in. And she looked at me, and she'd grown up in this area, you know, and she kind of laughed and said, "That's exactly the way I feel when I go east and I'm surrounded by mountains. You know, I really don't like not being able to see the horizon," or, you know, and I took that in and thought, well, you know, it really, it comes down to how you choose to look at it. You know, I mean, there are lots of things, I think, in any region where you're not happy with it or you're not, you don't care for it. And I think maybe we try, or we not try, but we tend to accentuate the negative more than we need to. So for me, though, I the flatness doesn't bother me in the way that it used to. I know there are places within driving distance, you know, within a day's driving distance, that are absolutely beautiful in any direction. There are three wonderful cities, Chicago, St. Louis, and Indianapolis, within a very short drive from me. And so you choose to decide what it is about your region that you want to be happy with, rather than feeling, well, I'm not so crazy about this.
I think when you can look out upon those fields, I can imagine, I've always been used to it, but I think there probably is this sort of realization of a kind of loneliness, especially if you are in a rural area, because you really can look and look and look and not see anyone. And you're still surrounded by these things that have been planted there. Corn, it's not, you know, like the mountains where you're surrounded by, stone and beautiful rolling creeks. And there are places here like that, but they're very dispersed. So I think there is... Even if you look at a painting of a farmhouse, often they're very tiny. They're in this huge space all alone. The sky goes and goes. And it can really feel like that sometimes. And I think that's why people that aren't used to it maybe can feel a little startled.
And that strikes me as curious, because urban life has its own particular loneliness.
That's right.
You don't have to go too far to find all those allusions to the lonely crowd and the idea that here in a city you could be living cheek to jowl with a lot of people and yet know nothing. You could live in an apartment building and you could know almost nothing about the person who lives in the next apartment, which seems a little strange. Again, if you compare that back to what life is like in a small town where everybody, for good or ill, where everybody knows everybody else's business.
Yeah. Now, I think there's a stereotype of the city as being lonely. And even as I'm listening to Philip and Becky talk about their experience of being in the Midwest, you know, visually, our experiences are so different, and yet we call it. Both of them are the Midwest, but Chicago is, I mean, just sort of visually, sensorially speaking, completely different.
Absolutely different world. But also interestingly enough, it's different. It's very different from other cities.
Yeah.
So you can't. I'm not even sure how I would put my finger on it, but it's really clear that, for example, that Chicago is different from New York. They're two very different places, and different again from, I don't know, from any, just about any other place.
Chicago has neighborhoods. I mean, real live neighborhoods, more than Manhattan does. I don't know about Queens or Brooklyn.
Yeah, Manhattan has, as growing up in New York, I would say that Chicago and New York seem closer to me as cities than any other two cities in America. They seem to have a lot of similar energy and similar neighborhood feeling and so forth. But, you know, when I first came here, I was very much aware of the fact that Chicago really felt an inferiority complex and was always comparing itself to New York and so on and so forth. And I don't really notice that anymore. I think Chicago has really come into its own and doesn't have to look over its shoulder all the time at the bigger city, either in the East Coast or the West Coast. And I think part of that is, you know, everybody has stereotypes. I mean, you know, let's talk about France and the French guy who has the Galois and he's wearing a beret, you know, and he eats pâté. I mean, all this, you know, and because it's easy to do, you know. And the problem is that people tend to internalize those stereotypes. So I remember before I moved out here, a group that I really loved, the Talking Heads, and they had this song called Big Country. I think it was the last song on their second or third album. And it was about David Byrne, just he's flying in a plane from one coast to the other, and he's looking down in the great central of the country. And he sees a house here and a cow there, and he's describing it, and it seems very idyllic. And then the chorus comes, and he said, I wouldn't live there if you paid me to, you know. And it's a wonderful rock and roll moment, but the fact is that it seems like it's okay to give hits like that to the Midwest, you know? And I think it's also easy, and I think the metaphor works here of if you fly above something, you don't see all the reality of it. So it's easy to take a look at the region and say, well, I wouldn't live there if you paid me to, but, well, what do you know of it? You're way, way high up looking down, you know? The British writer G.B. Edwards has this wonderful thing. He talks about some things that he didn't like at the time in contemporary writing when he was alive in the mid-century was helicopter thinking, and that would be when an author would hover over his characters or her characters and look down upon them. He says, you have to get on the ground. And I would do the same thing. I think too many people fly from the east to the west or fly from the west to the east, and that's all they see of the Midwest, and they don't see what's really there.
I also think there's almost a kind of Midwestern humility that keeps Midwesterners from really promoting themselves. I think that has to do with probably some of the types of immigrants that moved here in the beginning. Especially, I think, well, actually, I think this would include Chicago, too. I almost think there's this almost an unassertiveness, as if it's impolite to to stress your strengths. And I think in a way that and it's almost a kind of not a secretiveness quite, but a kind of keeping back information. And I think that's part of the reason it tends to get overshadowed by, say, New York and Los Angeles, which are both very assertive about themselves in certain kinds of ways.
And do you think we need a manifesto?
Yeah. That's right, Sharon.
Manifesto.
I mean, I think we need to redefine ourselves.
Uh-huh.
You know, we don't want to be just cows or inferiority or city. We are, what are we? I mean, the artists, you know, the Art Institute had the imagists for a while. We need a, you know, something visual that we can associate with ourselves that's got a lot more energy.
Let me, we have a caller, which I'd like to bring in, and let me, for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in, I think Asha should reintroduce our guests. On the telephone, Sharon Solwitz. She's a professor in the MFA Creative Writing Program at Purdue. Here in the studio, Philip Graham, who teaches creative writing here at University of Illinois, and Becky Bradway, who teaches creative nonfiction at Illinois State, and she is the editor of a collection of nonfiction writing about and from the Middle West. It's titled In the Middle of the Middle West, and it's published by Indiana University Press. And questions are welcome. We do have someone here patiently waiting. Line one, let's talk with them in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I do a good bit of photography, and I have found that the Midwest is believed by many people. It's a taught belief passed down that nobody or very few ever challenge or question. That it is not very photogenic, that it is not very interesting, that it is boring, that no one by choice would be there. This is carefully instructed and taught. And yet, you know, sometimes if you challenge these people, they look at you, they don't have an answer. But they've never been used to being questioned or challenged about it being so boring. Not too many years ago, I was attending an exhibit at the Phillips, which is in Washington, D.C., and because I have a camera and cameras, and I'm alert to those who have them, and so I saw a photographer there, a woman of mid-years, and because she had a camera that was I was familiar with, we fell into camera conversation. And she asked where I was from, and I said I was from the Midwest, and to be specific, Champaign-Urbana. Oh, she said, you have such wonderful light out there. I said, this is very true. And I said, where in the community where I live, I can be completely out of the community within 5-10 minutes. Just out, you know, there it is, farms, rural. And within no toll, no stress, gone. I'm out of it, and I'm into an agricultural garden. And not a problem. And we had some talk about it, and as I submit photography in competitions, and if any of them, I might say, are particularly favorable to the Midwest or depict the Midwest, many times those are just, oh, well, and they're passed over. And yet it never occurs to some of these jurors and various people, like, you know, seeing these photographs that look like they belong on the side of a wastebasket or a calendar that depict the idyllic road and the brook and the birch trees and all that. You know, that's so overdone, and that's a little boring, too. But I think it's very – I think the negativism regarding the Midwest is a taught belief, and it's erroneous belief. That's my thought.
Well, I appreciate the comment. Yes, I imagine everybody probably here would agree with you.
I mean, really? There's no absence of magic anywhere, I think. I remember once coming out of a movie theater with my family. I think we were watching that new Walt Disney Fantasia movie. And we came out and we saw that the sky was – probably the most beautiful sunset that we had ever witnessed. And it was so gorgeous that we wanted to get to a place where we wouldn't even have trees in the way of it. So we drove out to the end of the town, and we got to a little parking lot off an elementary school, and we sat to watch. And as it got darker, the sunset was even more brilliant, and we began to notice that we were across the street from a soybean field, and there were tens and tens and tens and tens of thousands fireflies that were starting to light up. And so we had to decide, what did we want to look at the most, the fireflies or the sunset? There was this wonderful, you know, double show that was going on. And then because it was close, about a less than a week before 4th of July, somebody in the neighborhood behind us started setting off fireworks. So then we had the sunset, we had the fireworks, and we had the fireflies. And it was literally one of the most magical moments. And a great deal of it was due, the first two were due to the geography of the place.
You can photograph storms and atmospheric conditions here in the Midwest area, and I'm referring to probably south of I-80, much better than you can anywhere else, because there aren't the tall buildings. We don't have a lot of smog that obscures whatever's in the atmosphere, all that kind of thing. You really can see and document atmospheric conditions of all kind, as well as this wonderful garden that is right here at your fingertips.
Well, we appreciate the comment. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Other people who are interested in calling in here and talking with us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I know that the collection here is nonfiction writing, but I guess I'm interested, since I have here with Philip and with Sharon on the telephone, because I know you have both published stories and novels,
yes.
So you have both have written fiction, and you teach writing of fiction. Whether you think your writing, what you write about, the way that you write. Supposing, Philip, you imagine that you were living in New York City. You had never come out here to Champaign or Mountain. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that your what you have written is different than it would have been if you?
Oh yeah, yeah. Though I have another background, which is, you know, accompanying my wife, a cultural anthropologist, to Africa and living in small African villages, and so that has deeply influenced me, I mean, enormously influenced me. But I think I have been influenced by living in the Midwest as well. I think the piece that I actually wrote for the anthology is about a very important moment in my life, where we were invited to a baby shower at this farmhouse that was about 10 or 12 miles outside of Champaign-Urbana, and the people who lived there had designed it in the craziest possible way. It was designed like a Polynesian hut with a heated pool and other sorts of things, and that nothing you would ever suspect if you drove past it, ever. And that set me up in some way for realizing, as I knew, but it really making it absolutely clear that the appearance of reality is not reality. You can drive by a farmhouse and think you know the stereotype of who the people who live there happen to be, but the place where I visited said, no, there's a wonderful imagination here, you know. Any place that can have carpet patches on the floor, the walls, and the ceiling for all their farm cats to crawl around on, in the living room, that's really wonderful, you know. And so I would have to say that it further reinforced for me the sense that, you know, you can look at a landscape, you can decide that you think you know all about it, and, you know, all you need is that one little key to realize you don't know a thing. It's very humbling, and it's very important, I think, for every writer to realize just where the marvelous can be found.
Can you answer that same question, Sharon, maybe whether you had stayed in Cleveland or maybe imagine having been in New York? Do you think that your writing, the things that you write about, the way that you write, would have been different if you had been living and writing in big city?
Well, I have to keep moving in order to write about another place.
Yeah.
I mean, I lived in Israel for a while. Actually, I haven't even written about it yet. But I wrote about India, where I lived for... I traveled around that area for maybe a year, and I couldn't write about it until I got home. Mm. I wrote about Cleveland when I moved to Chicago. I may have to move away from... the novel that I just published takes place in Chicago, and I think it's probably going to be the last time that I write about Chicago because I have to keep changing. Mm. The one I'm working on takes place in Michigan, which in a place where I was only I was only there for about, I don't know, maybe 30 minutes. I mean, we're looking for a house on the shore of Michigan, and I saw this amazing house on a bluff, and the bluff was eroding, and we were afraid to buy the house because the backyard was getting smaller and smaller. And I thought this is the place where I'm setting my new novel. I guess it's in the Midwest. Maybe I can say that it's the lake that's influencing me because I'm on one side of the lake and then the other side of the lake. I don't know. I mean, these are questions that I can't. I don't think I think I can. I can blather about them, but I don't know that I can answer them in any honest way, really.
I should ask Becky Bradway to talk a little bit more about some of what's in the collection that you put together, because I would also like to give people a sense of just the territory that is covered in here.
Sure.
And just are most of the I wonder how many of the people in the book, I don't know if you know, are transplanted, did come from someplace else, because there is sort of the comment that Sharon Solis just made did make me think about the issue of distance and the forest and the trees phenomenon, you know, whether indeed it takes somebody who grew up someplace else to come and live here for a while to tell us who grew up here, you know, stuff about the place that we don't really think about just because that's what we know.
Well, I think it can work both ways. I think it depends on the writer. I think some writers will, for instance, many writers continue always to write references to their childhoods or the place where they grew up, even if they're not still there. Whereas others, I think, are coming in from the outside. It's a real mix in this book. I'd say it's maybe, there probably are maybe 60% are from people that moved here. There are also people, though, that I know grew up in the area, and others I'm not entirely sure where they were originally from. A lot of these people, some of, you know, are academics, and in the academic life, people, in order to get their jobs, tend to have to move, at least at first. So some of them have been transplanted. Weirdly enough, many of them from the West Coast, California in particular, which was a fluke. I didn't expect that, but I think there are six essays in here from people that came from California, and then they write about Illinois and Iowa and compare all the ways they're the same. Well, go figure, that was a surprise. but once they said it, it made some sense to me. But there are others that, like Ricardo and Rodney Cruz's piece, His Set in Decatur, they're African American. It's a fantastic. They grew up in Decatur, and they're showing a very particular part of the life of growing up there. So there's really just a real range. And so I think everybody works a little bit differently. I think Stuart Dybbuk, I believe, is from the Chicago area originally, and he often uses a Chicago area setting for his fiction. And I've lived in New York for a year, and I lived in California for a while, and while I said a few stories in those areas, they never really had the depth that the stories I've written about Illinois have had. I just didn't feel that I ever really knew them very well, and it could be that if I'd lived there for 10 more years, I would have known it. But
and I'm thinking about Charles Baxter's Saul and Patsy stories, mm-hmm. where there's a transplanted New Yorker who's suffering culture shock when he comes to the Midwest. And there's this one, he uses the contrast of the East and the Midwest really beautifully to get across Saul's character. And he sets Saul in conflict with people who live here. And they're, I don't know, possibly they're caricatured a bit, but I don't know.
But there
is this sort of wonderful bounce when the East comes to the Midwest, and there's a kind of misunderstanding both ways.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite pieces is Maxine Chernoff's in this book, because mm-hmm. it's about the Midwest going to California, mm-hmm. and Maxine Chernoff's children really don't like California. Mm-hmm. They really miss Illinois.
Yeah.
They miss Chicago. And they're very, very articulate about what's wrong with California. What's the big deal about California? And it's wonderful to see that, you know. Mm-hmm. It actually reminded me of my own children who don't have much tolerance for mountains. It drives my wife and I crazy. I remember we once drove across country when we got to West Virginia. We were in the front seat going, "My God, look, mountains." And the two kids were sitting in the back napping.
I've seen mountains.
Yeah, nothing to them, absolutely nothing, you know. And I think that's an important thing, too, is not just people who come in and find their own culture shock, but people who leave and find their own culture shock and realize that what you've internalized is more powerful, perhaps, than you realized until you were aware of its absence. Mm.
We have some more callers. Let's bring them into the conversation here. Next in line, I believe, is Downs. That's line number 4. Hello. Yes.
This is interesting because I wanted to talk about California. I was born there and grew up there and stayed there until my husband took me away to the Midwest. And while I was in Los Angeles and then in Santa Barbara, we had a lot of connections with the Central Valley. That's where my mother was born, and that's where my father had family there. So we were there a lot. And that seems very Midwestern to me. I don't know whether anybody knows the central of the San Joaquin Valley, Sacramento Valley area. Mm-hmm. But it's very much like the Midwest. And I'm trying to think of writers from there. And
Robert Grindy's piece in this book actually talks about that area.
Really?
And all the ways that the two places are the same. And it was really interesting to me. And
well,
it made a lot of sense.
It's geographically, it's very flat. It's very dry, but it's very flat. And I remember sitting on an airplane with a young man who I don't think had ever been out of Illinois, who was going to work on a dairy in Turlock, which is in the Central Valley. And I thought, well, if you're going to transplant yourself to California from you know, Central Illinois farm boy, that's the place to go. Because it's going to be easiest. You know, the transition's going to be easiest for you. But that's interesting. I'm very interested in this book, and I will look for it. There are a couple of contemporary poets who are writing in the Central Valley. Well, I don't know whether Julia's there anymore. Julia Kasdorf and Jean Jansen. And Jean is still in the Valley, I know. And Maz Masumoto, Epitaph for a Peach, comes from there. Do you know that book?
I don't.
No, I don't. Sorry.
Oh, you should read that book. It's about trying to save heirloom peaches.
Hmm.
And it's a very philosophical sort of, also about the Japanese experience, the immigrant experience. Anyway, that's very interesting. I will look for the book. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We are getting to the point here. We're coming into about our last 15 minutes. Maybe I should mention again the book here we're talking about for people who would like to read it. It is a collection of literary nonfiction. From the Heartland. That's the subtitle. And the title of the book is In the Middle of the Middle West. It's edited by Becky Bradway, who is here in studio with us. She teaches creative nonfiction writing at Illinois State University and lives in Normal. And wouldn't we all like to live in Normal?
It's not that normal.
It's published by the Indiana University Press. And then also we have two of the contributors to the collection in the studio here, Philip Graham, who teaches creative writing here at U of I, and Sharon Solwitz, who is professor in the MFA Creative Writing Program at Purdue. And we have some other callers here, so let's try and talk with some more folks and go to Urbana next, line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. To go back to the philosophy kind of looking at why Midwesterners are the way they are and what their character is truly like, I think you touched on it, but it would be interesting to look at it a little bit further. If you grew up around here and you're used to the big skies and you spent some time on a farm and this becomes your world, what you have in front of you is something that's bigger than you are. When you're out looking at a sunset, as you described it, the world that you're looking at is so much bigger, and it makes you feel smaller. Hmm. Not in a bad way, but you're a part of something larger. And I think that gets lost in a big city. I think there's a kind of humility that comes with being out on the prairie, a kind of... you have to live with what is there. You can't conquer it. We do try, but I think that's part of the Midwestern character. And yes, the Midwesterner doesn't often put himself forward in the way, let's say, a big city person might. And when I've lived here all my life, and when I was at the U of I going to school, there was a decided difference between those people who were south of a certain point and those people who were from Chicago. And the Chicagoans really were, I mean, some of them, I swear, had never seen a cow before. And I think some of that difference has disappeared. Mm. But I think the ecology of this place has a great deal to do with who we are.
We'd see cows from outside the car windows. As place to place. I want to say, I know exactly what you mean. And in the city... Chicago, the only place you can go to feel small is the lake. And thank God there's the lake. Mm-hmm. You can go across it, but you can't see Michigan.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. In fact, something that Becky said before about looking at an artist representation of a farmhouse, and then, you know, it's always lost in the vastness, it reminded me of a connection I'd never made before of the Sung landscape painters in China, where you have these mountains and waterfalls and these giant landscapes, and then always in a corner somewhere there's a little house and a little person, and it basically the point is we are enormously small in relation to the larger world, and you could say that's as you just did say that's what being in this vast flat landscape does, is it puts us in our place, which is a good thing to do. Every morning when I get up my home page on the internet is the astronomy picture of the day, and it's always a galaxy or a distant, you know, exploding star or something, and it puts me in my place. I think Americans need or all people need to be in a sense put in their place in the universe and realize we're not the center of it.
One more thing, then I'll get off. I think the Midwesterner, because of this, because of the sunsets that he sees, which are absolutely fabulous, I think there's a kind of a delicious sense in knowing, there's a kind of an inward knowing about this that they don't really talk about. But I think that's also part of the character, a kind of, I'm not sure if I want to tell the rest of the world about this or not, but there's a kind, I don't want to call it secretive. It's not that. Mm-hmm. It's just a different sense of the world around you. Oh, well, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Before we go on to the next caller, can I just say that what I love about the anthology that Becky put together is not just about geography, that some of these pieces are really very personal and beautiful. And I just want to say that Sharon Solwitz's piece is a wrenching personal piece that is beautifully written. It's beautifully felt. It's one of the most powerful things I've read in a long time. So this has a, I mean, there's a lot of things besides just geography in this wonderful anthology.
Yeah, true enough. Sharon, did you want to say a little bit about the piece that you've contributed?
Well, only that, you know, as I was thinking about having this conversation, I was wondering how my piece fit into the anthology, because I don't think that it's rooted in the Midwest, or that it is much formed by the Midwest. I really have, I'm trying to, you know, I was trying to think, what can I say about it that will connected to what the theme of the book is.
I think I included it because it deals with a personal tragedy that's beautifully written about, and it's so, I don't know, it's so normal somehow. I guess what I was trying to get across was the sense that, yeah, we are formed by the geography, but there are also certain universal situations that any of us can find ourselves in, and they really do transcend the place that you're in. And I also think that for some reason, and this is really inarticulate, but that the piece does have a certain Chicago feel to it, even though Chicago as a place doesn't make a great many appearances in it. Mm-hmm. I think the book needed something like that. I didn't want to just have essays that were, this is about the Midwest, this is what the Midwest is like, and Midwesterners are all like this. I think in a way I was trying to sort of explode stereotypes and also say there are things that go beyond, you know, any characterizations we might make.
Yeah.
These universal
tragedies.
Whatever
place references that are in there are boys running down an aisle at Wrigley Field or skateboarding down Clark Street.
See, yeah. That's a lot.
The concrete references to place, if they're anywhere,
right.
Because it's nonfiction, mm-hmm. are where I live.
Okay. Well, let's talk again with some more people who are listening. Someone next in Champaign.
Thank you very much.
Online too. Hello.
Hi. Very good. I wanted to say that I think that part of the reticence of the rural community, especially, is that it's fairly young. They've had to work hard through six generations to make it, and I don't think they realize yet how much wonder they have in their lives and their history. And sometimes I see buildings come down that I think really have a story to tell. I'm thinking of a little interurban station at Warpella that just came down recently, but it had all the telephone, the electric posts, just wiggly woggly, and just absolute character. I'm thinking right now also of the Pepsin factory in Monticello, which has contained in it a whole bunch of the history of Monticello. That's where a lot of its wealth came from. Somebody, Carl Caldwell's great-grandfather, invented an elixir that became a rather famous pharmaceutical, and then others were tacked onto it. But this is a factory with 250 people working there, closed some while ago, but it is loaded with history. It also has a little asbestos and lead and a few things that you see in places like the Burnham Hospital, but it also has character, and it's in a place where there's other interesting things that people like to come and find, the Sangamon River, Allerton Park, just little bits of information, and I think sometimes those sorts of things disappear too quickly, and they're irreplaceable.
Well, that's another the built environment. We really haven't talked about that, have we? Well, we appreciate the comment. I don't know, you want to take that any further?
Well, personally, I think it's a great loss when these places are destroyed, and I think in the Midwest we have a history, you know, including in the urban areas like in Chicago in particular, where fantastic historical buildings have been knocked down in the name of progress. I guess my... This might just be nostalgia, but my own fear is that we're kind of getting into a point of almost a kind of universal suburbanization, where the fields are getting kind of supplanted by new subdivisions, and our old houses are getting run over by new subdivisions. You really see this in Bloomington Normal, where I live.
Over here, too, But interesting things always keep popping up. In a little town not too far from here called Sidoras, there's a maritime museum.
Yes, wonderful.
Who'd have thunk it?
I could tell a story about the Sidoras Jail, which is all of about 10 by 10 with planks right on top of each other. I don't know where it is now, but it's about the size to carry two drunks. And his order is wonderful.
Well, thank you very much for the call. Indeed, okay. We appreciate it. So have you been to the Maritime Museum there?
Two colleagues of mine, Bridget Kelly and Michael Madonic, told me about it. And like a day later, we drove out, and it was closed. But we hungrily looked in through the windows at all the ship models and, captain's quarters recreations and so forth. I mean, it looked so good, we almost wanted to break in. And it's right in the middle of the cornfield. It's a maritime museum. It's a legitimate little museum.
Yeah, all right.
Everybody should go.
To Urbana next, line number three. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I had one more comment about California. I didn't grow up there, but I lived in California for almost a decade, and Southern California. I couldn't stand it. I happened to fly back there a little while ago, and I mean, you could taste the smog coming off of the airplane. It was so gross. And likewise, you could taste the nice clean air coming back here to Urbana. And I've been here over a decade and a half, and I still can't figure out where else I would move if I were to go somewhere else.
Well, and a great tribute there to Central Illinois.
So anyway, that's all I had to say.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. We have maybe about 5 minutes left, a little bit less. Time for one quick comment if somebody wants to call in. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. What else can we say? I feel like we've sort of talked around the subject, and we've talked a lot about the essence of the Midwest. I don't know if we've really done quite justice to this book that we, although perhaps now people having heard about it will want to go out and take a look at it, which would be a good thing. Philip wants me to plug the signing.
Yeah,
come on.
Well, that's fine. No, I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to do that. I did mention right at the beginning that, scheduled to be six of the writers who contributed to this will be doing a signing at the Pages for All Ages bookstore in Savoy, and that will be tomorrow afternoon at 2:00. And this will also be some reading and some discussion of what's in the book and so forth.
I'm actually curious at how Becky organized this because, I mean, the writing is I think, all the contributors, I mean, except for me, of course, because I'm the worst. But
yeah, right.
Everybody's really wonderful in here, and some of them are so, so different. And I was just wondering, how in the world did you put it together? I mean, it's beautifully organized, but did that take a long
Thank
time
you.
For you to do that?
That was the hardest thing for me to do, I think. Mm-hmm. When I started with the idea of the book, I didn't really know what I was going to get. I was asking people to send me pieces, and I had no idea. I actually thought I would get a lot of things that were critical of the region, and I ended up with every conceivable point of view. And also things that are written very differently. Some are almost fictional in tone. Others are almost academically structured, more information based, and I did have to make a lot of decisions about how I was going to put things together. And I could have done it by state, or I could have done it by city, country, but I didn't want to do that because I didn't want to split up all this range. I didn't see necessarily the city and the rural areas as being in conflict with each other, or that in some ways that different. So I was trying to bring out similarities. So what I did is I ended up calling like a section geography. Obviously, those were the ones that were about the places. There's ones called outskirts. And what that ended up being, were either people that felt put on the outside by who they were, or some, for other reasons, felt like outsiders. It was very, very difficult. And in some ways, I don't think all the categories were quite right. But I did the best I could. I have a section called Rewind, which is all the memoir pieces. A lot of them go in that section. And what I wanted to do there was play off, have an urban section counterbalanced by a rural section, by maybe a mid-sized town, somebody doing something very experimental in structure versus someone that's doing something that's a fairly traditional story structure. So, And I tried to get them to sort of blend into each other by theme as you read the whole piece. So.
Well, there's a lot of good stuff in here, and I would encourage people to look at the book In the Middle of the Middle West, Literary Nonfiction from the Heartland. The editor, Becky Bradway, who is here in the studio with us, who also teaches at ISU, Illinois State University. The book itself is published by Indiana University Press. Also in the studio here is Philip Graham. He's one of the contributors, and he teaches writing here at the U of I. If you're interested in reading some of his writing, you might look either for his novel, How to Read an Unwritten Language, or story collection, Interior Design. And then joining us on the telephone, Sharon Solwitz. She's a professor in the MFA Creative Writing Program at Purdue, and her novel is Bloody Mary and story collection, Blood and Milk. So you can look for their fiction writing out there in the bookstore and the nonfiction in the book. And if you want to go to the signing, and that'll be tomorrow at Pages at 2 in the afternoon. And one more thing, launch party for the Ninth Letter.
Yes.
The new literary arts magazine from the U of I tonight at 7 o'clock, right?
At 7 to 9.
At the Plym Auditorium at Temple Hoyne Buell Hall. Mm. And anybody who's interested in is welcome to attend.
Everybody's welcome. Plus free food and drink.
All right. Can't hardly beat that.
No.
Well, Philip, thank you very much. And Becky. And Sharon, thanks all of you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks. It was fun.